This is Wade's World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World. It's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30 Central Standard Time in the United States, and your time for the voice of the people. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, where KABF 88.3 is located, or the east side of New Orleans, where WAMF 90.3 is housed, or Greenville, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kabf.org. A podcast will be available this show on Monday at that website. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to Lou Finford, veteran community organizer and co-director of MCAN. We're going to talk about not only what MCAN does, but also his recent experience in Hungary and Romania. Welcome to Wade's World, Lou.
Thanks for having me, Wade, and all you do for the world.
Well, and brother, we're in the same work. So first, let's tell people what MCAN does and how you've spent the last several decades in Massachusetts, and then we'll jump over to Eastern Europe and some of the interesting experiences you've had.
Sure. MCAN stands for Massachusetts Communities Action Network. And we are we call ourselves a faith-based community improvement organization. We work in ten cities in Massachusetts with six affiliated local community improvement organizations. And we support their local work on various issues like housing, healthcare, crime prevention, youth, and so forth. And then we also work at the state level on campaigns that we're currently involved in on raising the minimum wage to 15, passing paid family medical leave, passing a millionaire's tax, and criminal justice reform and immigrant rights.
Pretty much if there's any progressive issue that involves communities, MCAN is either leading it or right there in the play. Is that, that's a fair statement, isn't it, Lou?
We try to be. We try to be,
We all try to be. Okay, that's a good answer. Lou, you and I recently were over in Eastern Europe, and there's a fascinating, almost day-by-day report you did of your visits to both community and other based organizations in Romania and Hungary. Partly we're reprinting some of that in social policy and the issue that's in layout right now. What got you interested in Eastern Europe?
Well, I heard about this program, I think it was from you and also Dave Beckwith, who's an organizer in the Midwest that brings people who work in NGOs in Eastern Europe that are starting to do organizing or want to learn organizing. It's a program that brings them here, and they do an internship for a month with a U.S. community organization, and then the program allows the organizers from America to go to their countries to further work with those organizers and meet others there beyond the ones who came here. So I got to go in 2013 to Hungary for the first time on this program, and then last month to Hungary and Romania. It was additionally interesting to me because I've been, read a lot about the revolutions of 1989 that overthrew communism in Eastern Europe, and my grandfather is from Hungary, so there's a family question to it as well.
Well, I think you even found some sort of long-lost cousin or relative or something in one of your visits to Hungary, didn't you?
I did find my cousin, Georgi Floric, and it was kind of miraculous and help I got from one of the people in this program to track down records. And we got to meet and him and his wife 4 or 5 years ago when I was there, and then again last month when I was there. So that was great to meet a relative and learn more about the family history and you know, how they've survived these years going through what they've gone through.
I know you used to always advocate the organizers forum should go to Eastern Europe, so it's good that we're finally taking a close look. But yes. Hungary is a difficult situation for community-based organizing and activists, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really incredible. The president of Hungary is a man named Viktor Orbán. He was actually one of the figures in the leadership of the effort to overthrow communism in 1989. And he started a party called Fidesz that originally was more of a progressive populist party in a positive way. And kind of about 5 or 6 years into it, his party was losing traction. And there was reactions within Hungary, as there was in all Eastern Europe, to the shocks of the economic transformations they were trying to make from communism to capitalism, which left a lot of victims of most of the low and moderate income people in those countries. And then there were different reactions, mostly of more conservatives trying to assert themselves and gain political power back. So he ended up changing his party into a more conservative, very conservative direction. He's retained a little piece of populism. I think he's done some things about utility rates, but it's mostly been running against other people. There's elections in Hungary in about 2 weeks, and his whole campaign is focused on George Soros. George Soros is a Hungarian international financier, but he's a major funder of civil society, democracy, and organizing projects in Eastern Europe. Orbán has campaign posters all over Hungary with Soros's picture saying, don't let him have the last laugh, has pictures of Soros and opposition party leaders with photoshopped in them holding bolt cutters and standing at the border with the caption, don't let them let the hordes of migrants into our country. So it's really terrible, the kinds of things he's done. And the other thing, there's a rewriting of Hungary's history that's trying to go on that's really remarkable to see. Orbán built this museum called the Museum of Terror in Budapest that's on the site where both the fascist government in World War II and the communist government had their secret police. So part of it shows that history and the torture and all that stuff that's horrible. But then the overall message of it is Hungarians were innocent. We were victims of the fascists and communism, the poor Hungarians. And, yeah, they were terrible outside fascists and oppression, Stalinist oppression. But, you know, many hundreds of thousands of Hungarians were part of the fascist and communist, you know, terrible things that were done during those regimes. So it's really a rewriting of history that he's doing.
And it's
very dangerous.
It's very dangerous. And this is an authoritarian tendency, but we see it cropping up now in Poland. I mean, when you mentioned the sort of obsession with Soros, I actually was in Hungary for meetings middle of last year. And literally, you get off the plane and you see, you know, bus stop advertisements that attack George Soros. I mean, it's like they're trying to make him a household word, if you will. I mean, it's an obsession.
Right, right. It is, and it's just everything about outsiders and Jews and anti-Semitism, and it's kind of in Poland and government in Poland, Hungary, even though they were. Hungary, Fidesz, Orbán's party got 43% of the vote, but because of the parliamentary system, they got over two-thirds of the parliament seats, and they've systematically changed the constitution to consolidate power over the judiciary, the media, and all other areas of life. And the government in Poland is doing something similar. I think there's a term they're throwing around now. They're calling it illiberal democracy. It's really the Putin-style thing. There are elections, but there are so many suppressions that go on with the whole country that it's a fig leaf of a democracy, and it's really an autocracy and kleptocracy in effect.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, listeners will probably note that a situation where a minority government is able to gerrymander the seats so that they have a majority of seats and control judicial appointments and some of that sounds a little eerily like some of what we see coming on in various states in the United States, too. This is not something where we're living in a glass house on some of these issues. But you got to visit with people who are actually trying to work at the grassroots level. I know people with the Civic College and other groups that Mate Vargas and his bunch have supported. Tell us a little bit about what that looks like.
Yeah, that was really exciting. I mean, I think it's in the early stages. It's gone on for, you know, I'm not sure how many years, 5 to 10 years to start to build civil society, that there are community groups that have community organizers on staff, and they're working in all sorts of issues. You know, some are neighborhood groups, some are issue groups like housing prices, and some are dealing with employment issues. There's a whole set of groups working with Roma. Roma are the largest minority group in Europe, and they're severely discriminated against in all parts of life. Their economic and racial situation is kind of like African Americans were in about 1930. It's really incredibly terrible for them. So there are groups, you know, working heroically to try to build organizations. One of the organizations that worked on housing had a bill to try to stop, put a moratorium on evictions of women with children. And, you know, they unfurled this banner saying, a quote from Viktor Orban, the head of Hungary, saying there are no homeless women and children in Hungary. And then that morning, the parliament party, his party, voted down that bill. So they crossed out the no on this 40-foot banner. So then it read, there are homeless women and children in Hungary. So
and attributed that to Viktor Orban, which was a very nice tactic. I love that description in your piece. We're talking to Lou Finfer, a veteran community organizer from Massachusetts with MCAN, and we're talking about some of what he observed in Eastern Europe and a visit to Hungary and Romania. And you got out around Hungary a little bit, it looked like.
Yeah, I mean, not as much on this visit, but the one 5 years ago, did go out. I did visit a very incredible incident of an organizer who was working in a rural area in northern Hungary in a village, and we met with leaders of the Roma community who were meeting with a local politician to prepare for that meeting, and there was incredible interchange where the politician said, we treat all complaints the same. And then, you know, there was this pause, and you knew it wasn't true, but you know, organizers and leaders know sometimes a person can't rise to the occasion and gets tongue-tied. But this very moving and articulate, this Roma leader was able to say, that has not been our experience in our lives, and went on from there. So that was really moving to see that kind of a confrontation and the dignity of the leader in that situation. In Romania, I was there this time, and Romania is one of the poorest countries in Europe. You know, I learned about like rural areas of Romania where kids can't go to high school. They either have to commute 2 hours, 4 hours a day, or move to relatives in the city, or not go at all because they can't do that. They had a little bit different history than some of Eastern Europe. The communist government was overthrown. It was mainly the dictator Ceausescu, but most of the Communist Party officials continued to in power under other parties. And the system is rife with corruption, and there's been huge demonstrations of hundreds of thousands on the streets of Romania the last 2 years against the corruption. So people are really, I mean, there's a really control these governments have in Romania and Hungary and Slovakia and Poland, but there's really been people are not lying down and giving up. There's really been massive counter demonstrations on a large level as well as local organizing. But they're doing things like I know there are laws in Hungary that are restricting, and you know, the nonprofit organizing groups, they're demanding that they list on their website where they get their money from. They're proposing, if Orban wins the election, which is likely, I think they're proposing like a 25% tax on any foundation grants they get. So there are different kinds of ways they're trying to suppress the organizations, kind of like as we've seen in our country in so many places, the suppression of the vote by state legislators controlled by Republicans.
And this is, unfortunately, this sort of attack on nonprofits is, you know, something we're seeing currently in Russia over the last couple of years and now in India. This is a popular tactic, the sort of defunding, delegitimizing of nonprofit organizations. And it's a sad thing to see it in part of the EU as well. Now, in Romania, did they feel like they're making progress? I mean, these demonstrations have been huge over the last year, year and a half. Did you get a sense that they feel like they're turning the tide, or are they still just sort of knocking at the door?
I think they're knocking at the door, but the fact that they've been continuing to be able to do that shows that, you know, that the government is not getting their way. That while I was there, you can imagine, like, the head of the Justice Department announced that a special prosecutor looking into corruption was overstepping their bounds and not doing their job. So I'm saying to myself, am I reading about Trump and Mueller?
Yeah,
am I reading about Romania?
When we're over in Eastern Europe, we can't exactly hold our nose up higher than anybody else anymore. I mean, it's sort of like, ooh, that sounds a lot like home.
That's for sure. There was a group of really, I was really touched by this group of organizers in Romania, a group called SERI, that's led civil society organizing, and they had organized what it seemed like a set of neighborhood civic associations, and they were they were evaluating their work, and some of them had decided we're going to continue that work, but we need to target our organizing more toward more clearly toward low income Romanians, both Roma and non Roma, to make sure their voices are more part of it. So it doesn't have only a sort of, you know, partially middle class leadership. And then there was a group of five women that I was really touched by, but from SERI and a bunch of other organizations that had decided to take on the housing problem and try to develop a national campaign. The housing costs are very high, and there's the owners of private property before communism are allowed to petition to regain the housing in some cases and then displace people. And there are hundreds of thousands of people that don't even have a lease. And they talk about public housing not being, you know, they build this, there's this public housing I've seen in Hungary and Romania that's basically the walls of, there's a shell of walls, and sometimes there's electricity and sometimes they're not. There's not water, there's not plumbing. I saw this family of six living in a room that was about 6 by 8 with no water in it. They had to go in the hallway for water. And this is six people in a 6 by 8 room. And
I think people have no idea how small the housing units are in some of the social housing in Eastern Europe and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think, you know, they're trying to tackle it, and it's kind of like they're, you know, think about, you know, we're proud of some of the things we've done the last 50 years and also know the shortcomings. And they've kind of been at it, you know, kind of about 10 years. So they've done some things and there's a lot more to do. And then they're also battling, you know, the government suppression in some cases. And there's, you know, very few foundations or funding sources are really hard. The EU puts a lot of development money into countries, the European Union, but none of it really gets to organizing groups in any kind of way.
No, it's not a grassroots. We're talking to Lou Finfer from Boston, Massachusetts, longtime community organizer, co-director of MCAN, and about his recent visit to Romania and Hungary. Now, one of the things that struck me, you also had some very powerful discussions, meetings, I don't even know what you'd call them, that focused on how huge an issue sex trafficking is in Romania.
Yeah, that was really troubling and sad.
Heartbreaking
Romania,
to read.
Right. I mean, Romania, is the poorest country in the EU. And, you know, look at the realities of race that are part of sex, you know, in a sense, they're European, young women of European background and, you know, looks. And then the traffickers put out these ads saying, you know, come to Western Europe and we will get you a job and various things. And then people sign up and go. And then when they arrive, they're kidnapped and forced into prostitution. And this woman who's trying to work on this that I met with, she did this beginning of a sort of education effort in sections of Romania, and she was working off a $2,000 grant, and she'd go to a classroom in a school in a section of Romania, and she'd say, "How many people want to are planning or hope to go to Western Europe to work or live after you graduate?" And 80% of them hold up their hands.
Right.
They talk about a brain drain in Romania, but it is a brain drain, but it's really a working class drain because so many people work in Western Europe to support their families. The stories that I heard, also Romanians who are working in as migrant laborers in Sicily and also victimized there sexually and are working in as they're employed as elderly home care workers in Rome, but have to work 6.5 days a week. But the sex trafficking, it's just like really terrible. And I mean, we know it's terrible, but just to hear firsthand from someone who is doing it and know that Romania is like the biggest recruitment, is the country that's really focused on for a lot of the recruitment in Europe. And somehow I'm hoping to learn about, gosh, can we find an American foundation? You know, like she did this with $2,000, with like $20,000, she could be around the whole country or have others. Like, could we find someone in America to put up a tiny bit of money so that these women don't get crushed in their lives?
And we read in our own papers here in the U.S., Congress, I guess, yesterday tried to, or with this week certainly tried to pass something regulating how internet companies would have to take responsibility for sex trafficking on the internet. And clearly there are issues that people have raised around free speech and the liability of internet companies, but people have to take responsibility for their platforms. Let's just say we have to take responsibility for our organizations and all of the internet. The internet is the recruitment tool of first choice in many of these areas.
Right.
And some of these companies claiming to be, you know, whether it's Facebook or whatever, claiming to be so righteous about what good they claim to be doing while they're making their billions, they're allowing some pretty tough customers. And, you know, I think people don't really appreciate, I mean, in places like the UK, the largest minority group in the United Kingdom now is Polish. I mean, it's these workers from lower-income Eastern European countries have had to leave to get jobs, and obviously the EU border policy, you know, encourages and allows this, and it's been very positive for the economy. But it also potentially victimizes people if there are not real protections, and obviously that's not how the government in some of these countries sees their job. So.
Yeah, definitely. I went to one city with one of the women, Sylvia and Nikita, that we went with. Her city used to have 100,000 people and now has 75,000 people, and all the loss is people working abroad and sending wages back.
And certainly we heard in Slovakia and Bulgaria as well.
I mean,
hundreds of thousands of people that have been, you know, forced to try to get a living wage someplace. And Slovakia, it was sort of an irony. They're getting all these auto plants or constructing there, and now they're not sure they'll be able to staff them because so many Slovakian workers are out of the country working elsewhere. You know, it's like, you know, they're looking for the lowest possible wage, so they locate there, but people don't want to work for the lowest possible, you know, and we know that from living wage campaigns. Well, before we leave, tell us some stuff about what's happening with MCAN in Massachusetts. Because I know I saw you recently up there, and I know you're busy.
Yeah, we're about to head up to our state capitol in about an hour because this criminal justice reform bill that we and other groups have been working on for 4 years that just sprung, it just was the passed by the major joint committee of the legislature, so we'll know what they're going to do on things we're trying to work on, like repeal of long mandatory minimum sentences on drug charges and reform on restrictions of ex-prisoners on jobs. And then we're heading toward the ballot where, you know, there's organizing going on seriously on three ballot issues that will be on the ballot this year for, you know, the fight for 15 to raise the minimum wage to 15, for paid family medical leave, and for an increased tax on millionaires that would raise $2 billion for education and transportation. So, you know, we got our hands full, but the ballot, and not only half the states allow ballot issues, but
right.
It's certainly been a breakthrough for us to have that, because otherwise a governor, a speaker, a Senate president can block a major legislative issue. But if you can collect the signatures and get it on the ballot and campaign for it, you can go around them. So it's really added to the you know, the power and the strategies that we've had to be able to do these ballot initiatives like we've done this year and that we did in 2014.
And the other way it just builds huge power for community-based organizations is that it demonstrates that we're not afraid to have our members and supporters' interests put to the test of the voters. And the fact that, I mean, I don't know how many signatures are required now in Massachusetts, but it's not a small number, is it?
Yeah, no, you have to get 120,000 or to qualify in a like a 8 or 10 week sort of window only. But it's a great leadership, as you can imagine, Wade. It's a great leadership development thing.
Oh, absolutely!
All your members, if they collect 10 signatures or 1,000 signatures, they're all contributing in such a concrete way to the campaign and the victory. So it's a great leadership development, to do that. That's available when you're doing those referendum campaigns.
And it helps us sustain the campaign once the huge influx of money usually comes in the last month or so to try to turn that support against us. But now balancing a whole bunch of initiatives at the same time, that's a tough job.
Yeah, we're worried about it. I mean, there's a possible path that one or two of these could be, there could be a legislative compromise that's favorable enough for us to not to go to the ballot. But, you know, we don't want to give away the core of it or the most of it. But to think about having three things on the ballot and the business community may have something on the ballot to cut the state budget that we'd have to oppose. So it's, you know, we're all kept busy. But everyone's trying to step up on things we can do about the excesses and terrible things the Trump administration is doing. But obviously in organizing, there's still a lot of available significant stuff at the city, neighborhood, and state level that we can do and that Trump can't squash in most cases.
Well, and where the opportunity exists in places like Massachusetts and California and many others, unfortunately not some of the states where our listeners are right now, like Arkansas or Louisiana or Texas, but we need to have bulwarks built against some of these policies. And so these are important initiatives that put people on record, let people know exactly where the fighting lines are going to be drawn. And Massachusetts people give it a bad reputation as being too liberal, but that's not the whole state. I mean, it's a real fight out there in some of the countryside to get these positions across. And it's if Massachusetts can do it, it says that other people can do it too. Look at the healthcare initiative.
Yeah, definitely. And some red states, a bunch of red states did pass minimum wage increases through the ballot, not as big as some other states, but had the work not been done by the community and labor groups in those states, that wouldn't have happened.
How can people get back to you or support MCAN or your work before we leave, Lou?
Well, probably the best, maybe, I don't know if you can share an email address over the air. Probably just to email me. My email, I'll spell it out, but it's loufinfer@gmail.com. The Lou Finfer is all one word, and it's spelled L-E-W-F like Frank, I-N like Nancy, F again like Frank, E-R, and loufinfer@gmail.com. And then I'll respond and would have great respect for the work that your network, both in this country and around the world, is doing, Wade, and look forward to continue to work, find ways to work with you and the network of people you're organizing with.
Thanks so much, Lou. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wade's World.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.